Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
And welcome back to the Final Inspection Show, brought to you by the legendary Great Lakes Dragway Union Grill, along with David Hobbs Honda, 6100 North Green Bay Avenue, for the best in not only new cars, but a wide selection of Honda-certified used cars and a wide variety of used cars, too. And joining me in suite number 5 at picturesque Road America, it is David Hobbs. Thanks for joining the show, sir.
Thanks for having me on again, Steve.
We've been selling a lot of books this weekend.
We have. Hobo, which I brought out March of 2018, is going very well. And obviously an IndyCar crowd here today, Friday. We've had a very nice run today, and hopefully over the weekend too.
You and I were chatting about it, and you think, you know, people have bought their, you know, have bought the books, and we're probably going to be seeing the same people. But we did a nice little thing last night at Siepkins for Racing Kids for Cancer, and with good crowd, and people were coming in. We're happy to see us. We even had some a couple of gentlemen from Texas and people from Pittsburgh, and I mean, it was a really nice crowd, and they love the book, and it's kind of a cool book.
Oh, well, thank you. I must say that two or three people have popped onto the shop. I'm selling it out of the gift shop here at the track, and a couple of people have come and said, "Hey, I've already got it. Lovely, great read, and I keep saying, well, say that louder to this gentleman right here who's thinking about buying one. So people have read it, seem to like it a lot, because it covers a lot of ground. It covers from my first race in 1959 right to the end of my TV career last year. So, I mean, that's a lot of ground to cover, like 60 years of racing and TV.
A lot of people think your first race here, and I did for a while, was the first race here was a Formula 5000 race with Surtees in 1969. But actually, you raced here earlier in, what, 64?
I came here in 1964 with a Lotus Cortina from the Lotus factory. It was a factory car, a Lotus Cortina being a sedan. Mm-hmm. And we were sent out to do the 500. I'm not sure if it's the Pabst 500 or what 500 it was, but
that would have been like an under 2 liter then?
Exactly. 1999, that car. So, but unfortunately, the lady in Lotus in England, I guess she looked at a map of America. And she put us in a Holiday Inn in Madison. Well, in those days, there was no I-43.
Right.
And we kept trying different routes cross-country from here to Madison. The other thing that none of us limers were used to, of course, was all this County A stuff. County A, County B.
Right.
County BB.
I'm a city person. I'm still not even used to it.
And the fact is, of course, between here and Madison, there are about three counties. Mm-hmm. And they've all got a County A. So the locals would say, well, you go down here to get to County A, then you go down there, go north on County A until you get to County CC and go east. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Well, unfortunately, of course, as soon as you're out of that county, it's not County A anymore. It's
right.
Something else. So we had a lot of fun going back and forth to the track. I honestly can't remember how we did in the race.
Who was your co-driver?
I think I was driving with a guy called Chris Kraft, who was another English driver of my era. And Chris did a lot of saloon car driving in England, sedan car driving, that is. And I can't remember how we did, and I can't remember who even won the race. It was probably a chaparral. I mean, we were probably being lapped about every 5 laps.
We have to ask Tom Schultz for that, the resident historian of Road America, good guy. And then, the Formula 5000, that's always an interesting story, too, in 1969, because you were running Formula 5000 in England. And then you came over towards the end of the summer to race Formula 5000, and you and I think with John Cannon were racing right to the end for the championship.
Well, it was.
Or is it Tony Adamowicz?
Tony Adamowicz. What happened was that John Surtees, who had decided to make his own car, so he made the first car was a Surtees TS5, which was designed by a chap called Len Terry, who was an English car designer at the time, and he had designed the Gurney Eagle, which, in fact, if you go and look at the Eagle on display at in the museum, at the Collier Museum in Naples, Florida, the front suspension on the Eagle and the front suspension on the Surtees were absolutely identical. But I did a couple of races in England, and I finally, we had our first win in a place called Mondello Park in Ireland, and that was in June. And then I had been he'd been trying to set up a deal with James Garner, who had got all hot to trot on racing. James had a big sponsor out of Riverside, California, not far from where your last guest came from, who was a big, he made motorhomes. Not so much motorhomes as mobile homes. And anyway, it fell through, like pretty well everything that poor old John Surtees did. So in the end, he decided to bite the bullet and sent me out on my own with a chap called Dennis Davis, who was a mechanic for a long time with McLaren and other people. Done a lot of Formula One work, and he and I came out and we're like this dynamic duo driving all around North America. And we came here and we stayed at Sharp Summer Resort, which is really where those condos on the lake are now.
Right.
And God, I mean, I remember the bugs being just grotesque. Had the car up on stands in the driveway at the motel working on it, trying to change in the engine or something. And anyway, it was 3 100-mile heats. And I was pretty close to the front in qualifying. And going down into the kink on lap one, heat one, I was alongside the local hero, Jerry Grant, who, of course, I knew nothing about Jerry Grant. Anyway, I went to the kink, and I suddenly realized there was nobody behind me. And there'd been a massive shunt down there. Cars going off in all directions. Now, I'm sounding a bit like the granny now, who says, I've never had an accident, but I've seen lots in my mirror. And so I'm wondering if there was something that involved. Anyway, just as I pulled up to the start-finish line, there was a red flag, so the whole thing was called off, and it went on to 7. So I did really one lap of the 300 miles, which was my really first venture here. And then, of course, I hadn't been here since 64. And after 1969, I basically ended up racing at Road America at least once, if not twice a year, until 86.
With, was it with IMSA?
Formula 5000, with IMSA, Trans Am, Can Am. You know, I had to go at everything here. And as I say, I usually ended up having at least, well, every year I had at least one race here. And some years I'd come here two or maybe three times. And in the end, I had some good success. I won the 500 twice.
The one time in 79, you weren't even expecting to win it with BMW.
We weren't expecting to finish with the big key, you know, because that car, that little BMW 320 Ti Turbo, was gave a lot of horsepower for the day. You know, 2 litres, it was giving 700 horsepower. Massive throttle lag with the turbocharger. And it was not the most reliable vehicle I've ever driven. So Roger Bailey was the team manager, and me and Tyler Alexander, because the car was run by McLaren North America out of Detroit, we were all saying, well, is it even worth going? You know, gosh, we can't even do a 100-mile race without the thing breaking. Anyway, I had Derek Bell as my co-driver, and Derek Bell, of course, was an incredibly lucky race driver. I mean, he won the Le Mans 5 times. And he comes along, and we won it. Couldn't believe it. It was amazing.
How did one fight turbo leg back in those days? Was it a timing deal?
Yeah, you go into the corner and you just had to get it right, because obviously turbo lag wasn't always exactly the same.
Right.
Depending on the rev and what gear you were in.
Sure.
It made a bit of a difference to how long the lag lasted. So you had to get used to it and work it out when it was going to come on boost. And you obviously wanted it to come on boost right about at the apex. You didn't want it to come on boost just before the apex. I mean, I'd driven at Indy by then, and of course there it was easy. You just brake with your left foot and kept the throttle open a bit,
right?
So it kept the turbo spinning, but not much boost. And then of course you just lift off the brake and off it go again. But road racing was a bit difficult, and of course it's only a little engine. It's only 2 litres, one great big turbo, and 4 cylinders. So when the 935 came along with a 6-cylinder engine and 2 turbos. Their lag was significantly less. Plus, of course, they had a lot more horsepower when the thing wasn't in a lag mode, because it was like a 3.5-litre engine, so it had much more grunt anyway.
And then, of course, the 962s in the 80s, of course, with John Fitzpatrick and that. That was how big was IMSA back then? If the fans who may not be, or listeners, are not old enough to remember those days.
Well, IMSA was very big, and I'm glad to see it getting really big again. It seems to have made a massive resurgence in the last couple of years. And, you know, the race coming up here in August is going to be, I think it'll be a really, really good race. Now, they are screwing around with their classes again, which sanctioning bodies are tend to do. I'm not sure that that's going to be the best thing in the world for IMSA. It's so hard to tell because you get these guys making the rules and regulations and they think they're doing it for the best of the sport and sometimes they don't. And, of course, the prime example in my mind was Formula 5000, which I ran for a long time, from 1969 until 1974. And, I mean, that was one of the best classes that we had here, road racing. And all the promoters and the SCCA all said, nobody wants to watch single-seaters on racetracks. They want to watch cars with bodywork, Can-Am, Trans-Am. So they took the Can-Am cars and the Formula 5000 cars and turned them into Can-Am cars, which was when the first big Can-Am had gone away.
Right.
But, of course, it never made it. And right after that, Champ car racing came along, which, of course, was USAC, and it turned into Champ car, which was the Indy car that we know today, but run under Champ car rules. And suddenly, I mean, everywhere had these massive crowds, places like Mid-Ohio, Road Atlanta, Road America, had the biggest, some of the biggest crowds they've ever had. And what were they watching? They were watching single-seater racing cars on road racetracks.
Exactly. You
know, which is where the guys had got it all wrong. And I feel that the IndyCar of today probably should really be a Formula 5000 car that's evolved.
And for those that are not familiar with it, a Formula 5000 car is basically almost like a Formula 1 car, but with a stock blocket motor, a 5-liter, naturally aspirated, and, I mean, for the price.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think of it, Surdy sent you over here with one mechanic. And how much support did you get with? I mean, if you needed an engine, was that something he would set up, or how did that work out?
Well, we had the engines were done by Al Bart out in California.
Okay.
And so we used to just we only had about two or three engines, I think, in the chain.
It was just you and your mechanic.
Yeah.
Two people.
And we were based just outside Toronto in Canada. So we went everywhere from Toronto. So because every time you cross the border,
Mossport wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
But
oh my God.
Were you hitting Edmonton then too?
Went to Edmonton, and but I mean, most of the races were in the U.S.
Laguna Seca. That's quite a haul.
It's a haul from Toronto. And of course, any time any engines came back into Canada from California, you had to go through customs, and you had to have paperwork, reams of paperwork, to get the damn thing in and out. And, are you sure you're not going to sell it? Are you going to sell this? No, this is our engine. We're going to use it. So, it was a bit inconvenient, but we were at a little shell garage there that John Surtees had met when he first started doing Can-Am. Well, actually started doing the USRRC, which was before Can-Am. This is 1965. And he had met this guy called Ronnie Mutton, who owned a shell station in Bowmanville, Ontario, which is a little rinky-dink town then. Now, of course, it's huge.
Right.
It's practically all part of Toronto. But so we were based there for 2 years, and so we started here at Road America, and of course it was actually race 7 of the series. And as I said, I did one lap. But then we got into our stride, and I was significantly quicker than most of the other people in the series. And the I ended up having 3 wins, and I lost the championship by 1 point to Tony Adamowicz, who won it by 1 point. And I think he might have won here, but he only had 1 win in the year, and nobody else in the series had more than 1 win, and I had 3 and I only did half a series, and I lost the championship by 1 point. Then we came back the following year, 1970, and again we started halfway through the year, and I could only come third that year, having done half the races. Then the year after, I changed teams, drove for Carl Hogan out of St. Louis, and in a McLaren M10A, and we won 5 races and won the championship.
Very good. And what was your last race here?
My last, what I 89? Call my last real race was probably 86.
Oh, with BMW prototype.
I might have come back in 87 with my son Greg. We drove a 320 here.
Okay.
Owned by a guy called Leo, out of Chicago. He's a nice chap. And he was a big fan of the Hobbs family. And he wanted Greg to do well. And we raced his 320. I think Greg and I raced his 320 here. He might have driven it as well. But my last real race was the BMW prototype in 86. And that car was dynamite. Now, that was the same engine I raced in the BMW 320 in 1977. But since then, BMW have done a tremendous amount of engine development. And in 1984, they won the world championship in Formula One cars with a BMW engine in a Brabham. Nelson Piquet was the world champion, and they won the championship with the Brabham and a BMW engine. So when we took it on again in 1986, it had improved enormously from 1977. And it gave in qualifying trim, it gave 1,000 horsepower.
Amazing. From such a small engine, too.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they had stroked it to make it a full 2 litre instead of like 1950.
Right.
Which unfortunately caused a lot of vibration. So we had early season issues with vibration breaking pipes, like gas pipes, which caused the fire. But it was one of my most disappointing races ever here, because we were on the front row, and the hero of those days, the leader, was Al Hulbert and Derek Bell in the
Lone Brown
950, yeah. 62. And I remember coming up this main straight right outside this window here, and I was right behind Derek driving the Lone Brown car. And he was second, and I was about to lap him, which would have been very, very, very good for me. And going down into turn five, it suddenly, the engine just stumbled and bumbled and just, and it choked itself, and it stopped down at turn five, and I fiddled around with it, because I couldn't do anything. And I managed to stagger back to the pits through the infield. Anyway, some wire had broken in the electronic control unit and had put it onto full rich.
Ah.
So in the morning, when it was cool, on the Monday morning, mm-hmm. it just fired right up, because it was like pulling the choke out.
Right.
It's like pulling the choke out and hanging your handbag on it, you know. they don't work too good when they're that rich. And it just went over rich and stopped. So that was very disappointing.
And then your last race, of course, was WEC 1990, but you have never officially announced your retirement. Is that true?
This is true. There is time left. Well,
it is, you know, being at some of these book signings and that, and being spending some time with you, you still get offers to drive many vintage cars, and I think your explanation on why you don't makes a lot of sense. And why don't you tell the listeners, why don't you drive vintage cars?
Well, I was extremely fortunate in my racing career that I raced for 30 years, from 1959 to 1989. And I was on the TV from 1976 to 2018. But in all my races, I never got hurt. And I raced through probably the most dangerous era ever of racing, because cars, and particularly tyres, developed at an astonishing rate, and speeds absolutely rocketed. But of course, track safety didn't change for the first 10 years at all, and nor did car safety much. Nobody thought about the safety side of it. They just thought about making it light and fast. Mm-hmm. So it became very dangerous, and somehow in all that time I never so much as even broke a finger. Now Brian Redman, one of my best friends, says, well, in that case, lad, you obviously weren't going fast enough. Well, I went fast enough to win a couple of championships and quite a few races. So I just look at it now and I say, why would I stick my neck out and drive a car that's 30 years old that wasn't very safe 30 years ago, and it sure as hell is not any safer now than it was then. And I brake a lot easier. And if anything does break, it takes forever to fix.
I remember the first time I saw a Porsche 917 in person. And, of course, as a kid, you know, you're a big fan of the movie Le Mans with Steve McQueen and everything. And you see the 917s, and, in fact, you drove one. And, you know, you look at those cars, okay, and they look, you know, kind of big. Then when you see one in person, I was shocked at how small it was. And then I remember getting up close to one, looking at it, and going, where's the firewall? There is no
firewall.
There's no fire. It's just fiberglass between you and that air-cooled engine.
A thin piece of fiberglass.
Yes.
No, and of course the 917 was a space frame car. If you take the bodywork off, you look at it and you think, how the hell?
Not much there.
There's not much there, and at one stage Porsche even put pressure gauges on the tubes. They pumped them full of nitrogen, and if you saw the pressure gauges above your head, and if the pressure dropped, you knew the chassis had cracked somewhere. They were a bit of a flexible flyer. I mean, they were fast as hell. But, I mean, to say they were safe would be definitely a misnomer.
Brian Redman has a great story about testing that car.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We won't go into that.
No,
now.
We won't get into that now. That's
in case Porsche are listening.
But, yeah, it is amazing. And you know, it's ironic that here we go. Here we are in 2019, and we have the Red Group, who is so integral in emergency safety and everything, sponsoring the event this weekend, the NTT IndyCar Series at Road America. And, you know, I took a very roundabout way somehow ending up in radio, but my first job in racing was track safety. And so I've always had kind of an interest in it, and I just remember looking at that 917 going, what is going on? Where's the rest of the car?
Well, the cars, and of course the tracks were a joke. I mean, I first went to Spa, Belgium in 1966 in a GT40.
Barbed wire is insane.
And of course, exactly. I'm in a GT40, which has got bodywork around it. But as you went out on that long master straight, it was a downhill straight about 2 miles long, and it had a bit of a kink through the village, so there's houses and sidewalks and lampposts right at the side of the road, not a trace of guardrail. And, of course, people sitting in their lawn chairs right at the apex of the corner, so they get nice and close to the racing cars. And the clipping point as you exited the village was a utility pole made of concrete against which they lent a straw bale. And, of course, last weekend was the anniversary of the Belgian Grand Prix, which would be 1962. So that is, what, nearly 50 years ago. And two drivers were killed that year. Chris Bristow went off the road and was decapitated by the barbed wire fence. And Alan Bristow was driving a Lotus and he got hit in the head by a bird.
That was a bad week.
Tracks were not safe. And Stirling Moss, actually, in practice for that same event, had gone off on the bank at Bourneville Turn and had broken both legs.
And Willie Maurice was involved with
Willie
Maurice,
he could have been. Willie Maurice was involved in a lot of crashes over his career.
He was thrown from the car to safety, which was...
Well, of course, when seatbelts came in Europe, a lot of drivers were very skeptical about it because they thought, no, it's much safer to be thrown from the car. But, of course, from those days, maybe with the fire and the way the car just crushed around you, maybe. Nowadays, I mean, the way these cars bounce off these walls at Indian places like that, it's just absolutely staggering. Anybody survives it.
I sent you a photo, and I forget the gentleman's name, who's become my hero, the Irishman. In fact, you were talking about the place in the Formula 5000. He was the heavyset guy who actually survived a couple of races. He got killed. He was the big guy that was driving that old Lotus, the heavyset guy.
Oh, Chris Summers.
Chris Summers, yes.
Yeah.
Fascinating. And here's a guy who had several accidents, never. And you see him, he's sitting in this Lotus, and it's cut away, and you can see clear as day. No seatbelts.
Oh, no. And, of course, Chris Summers was a heavyset guy.
Big guy, yes.
And, I mean, he bulged out over the top of the bowl. So nowadays you can only just see the top of the driver's head because of all that safety stuff around you.
You can see him mid-torso up.
His elbows are out over the side of the chassis, and he's grappling with the wheel. And, I mean, you're half out the car already. When the thing turned over, I mean, your head's the rollover point.
Exactly. Well, David, we certainly appreciate you coming out and enjoying the fantastic weather finally in Wisconsin at the Rev Group NTT IndyCar Series up here in Road America. Make sure you come out. there's still time to come out for Saturday, today, and then also tomorrow is the big race. So come on out. It's a fun event, great action, and who knows, you might even see David Hobbs
walking
around.
Well, if you're very lucky, you might see me walking around.
Yeah. Look for the mob of people chasing you.
Yeah, just look for the mob, and then I'll be in the middle of that.
David, appreciate it. You've been listening to the Final Inspection Show, brought to you by the legendary Great Lakes Dragway in Union Grove and David Hobbs Honda. Where is David Hobbs Honda again?
6100 North Green Bay Avenue, Glendale.
Very good,
where
sir.
Where every car is a sale deal.
Thank you, David.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.